We spend billions of dollars in this country to try and hide our age. You know, we dye our hair. You know, we get our faces lifted, our nose jobs, wrinkles removed. And we're proud of the fact that we are old, as Maggie Coon calls us, the wrinkled radicals. And we feel that that we have a contribution because everybody's going to be old someday.
I heard that I could go out here to the Dallas School Board.
D-I-S-D.
Dallas Independent. And they were going to talk about getting a bunch of senior citizens, that's me, if not have you recognize it. They're going to take us senior citizens out there and show us how to run that camera. And do all the other little things.
In the United States, we have 37 million people that do not have access to health care. 13 million of those are children. 10 million children in this country have never seen a doctor.
We actually know what the solution is. If poverty is a lack of income, then money is the solution, right? How you get it is a bit of a question. But there's no question about what the solution is.
We all start aging at the moment of conception. If we're lucky, we will age for a long time. But this also brings other problems with it. We'll discuss this right now on Alternative Views. Alternative Views, we're going to be discussing three things which affect all of us: age, aging, and ageism, age prejudice. We will have a discussion with two people from the Gray Panthers: Francis Humphreys, who's the director of Gray Panthers National Office in Washington, D.C., and Irv Riskin of the Membership and Organizing Committee of the Gray Panthers. Also, we'll be talking with Nancy Amade, who's a writer, social activist. She'll be talking about poverty. And we'll see a mini documentary by Carol Lewis about a group of senior citizens in Dallas, Texas, who are making their own public access program after being organized by the American Association of Retired People. But first, let's talk to our two Panthers. The Gray Panthers are in town. They're having their Midwest conference here. And we're real fortunate to have some people who've come in from Washington, D.C., and they're going to tell us about not only what the Gray Panthers are like, but what they're doing, and what is happening in Congress, and all kinds of interesting things about the Gray Panthers. We have Irv Riskin, who is on the Membership and Organizing Committee of the Gray Panthers. He's a former labor organizer back in the 30s. And he's also a board member of the Gray Panthers. And we also have Francis Humphreys, who's the director of the Gray Panthers of Washington, D.C. National Office. She has a difficult job of educating those Congress people up there. Well, there are so many things we can talk about because the Gray Panthers has such a broad range of interests. But I guess, first, can you tell us, what are the Gray Panthers?
Well, the Gray Panthers are an intergenerational organization. We're not a senior organization. We're an organization that consists of young and older people. We're advocates for the elderly, but we also are as firm advocates for children, the poor, the hungry, the unemployed, the workers in the plants.
Mm-hmm. Irv, how did you get the name Gray Panthers? Sounds like a 60s concept.
Yeah. Well, it is. You know, we formerly were known as a consortium of younger and older people because we were born out of the Vietnamese War at the same time when we were involved with Vietnam. And we were invited to participate in a television broadcast in New York City. And Maggie Kuhn was there with a group of younger people. And the discussion was so heated, and we were so intense in our defense of the younger people and our opposition to the war, that the commentator said, "You people ought to be known as Grey Panthers." And the name has stuck with it ever since.
Well, Francis, what is the extent of the Grey Panthers? Is it nationwide? How many people are in it and all?
Oh, yes. We have networks across the nation. There are about 70,000 of us across the United States. In our local networks, of the activists that are out on the streets demonstrating or going to the state legislatures, we have about 7,000 Grey Panthers actively working every day, just about it.
Well, now, what differentiates Grey Panthers from some of the other organizations which are concerned with things for the elderly, for instance? I mean, besides being intergenerational.
That really is the main thing that differentiates us. We are, let's put it this way, what we are not is a special interest group for the elderly. We're not out to get the elderly a better deal at the trading post. We are, we're out to bring about social change in this country for everybody.
And what is your national agenda right now? What are some of the current issues you're working on?
Always peace is a number one issue with us. Another one is the very sick state of health care in this country. We really want to see this country join the other civilized nations of the world with a national health program.
And what are you doing to try to get a national health program brought about?
Okay, we have a two-pronged approach to that. We have a short-term and a long-term strategy. We just can't forget that right now there are problems that we have to work on. There are people, we have, in the United States, we have 37 million people that do not have access to health care. 13 million of those are children. 10 million children in this country have never seen a doctor. We just cannot ignore that. So we work on that issue, and while we do that, we're documenting the case for a national health system. Our long-term goal, of course, is the national health system. We have a National Health Service Task Force that works solely on that long-term goal, and we're working on every level we possibly can to bring that about.
And what about Congress? Are they receptive? Do you have some people that you're working with in Congress that are planning to introduce some legislation sometime?
Yes. Congressman Ron Dellums from California has just introduced a National Health Service bill. This isn't the first time he's introduced this. He's been introducing it for a few years, but as time goes by and people begin to realize that that we're approaching, or we're not approaching, we're at a crisis condition, they're becoming more and more interested in the national health system, and as the country responds, Congress takes notice, and I think Ron Dellums is feeling more and more support for this bill. There are some other bills. Congressman Roybal from California has introduced a bill. He calls it U.S. Health. It's not a pure health service as Dellums is, but nevertheless, it's a national plan.
Yeah, I think it's so ironic here. The Congress people themselves have socialized medicine. They got all their benefits, and yet they won't vote for it the rest of it. There's a curious situation I saw when I was in the Navy. I saw a chief petty officer who was giving a lecture to some young sailors talking about, hey, they ought to ship over, they ought to re-enlist because think of all the benefits. And he was listing free medical benefits, free dental benefits. And then about an hour later, I heard him talking politics with some of his cronies, and he was talking about socialized medicine. We can't have that. That's
actually, health really should be viewed as a right, mm-hmm. just as it should be looked at as public education. We decided years ago that we were going to educate the people in this country, and so we went into a public education system.
why don't we decide right now that we're going to give health care, we're going to have a healthy nation? And we hear a lot of talk about, will the United States be able to compete with the other nations? Well, the first thing we need to do is to put in place a health system so that we have a nation of healthy people.
Well, what about the other Western capitalist countries? They all have it, do they?
They all have it. As a matter of fact, the one country that we're in partnership with in this issue is South Africa.
Even South Africa has a...
No, South Africa and the United States are the two countries
with
a national health plan.
Let's look at this situation more closely with the person who was the keynote speaker for the Grey Panther Conference, Nancy Amedee. She looks at Social Security, poverty, and Reaganomics.
Nancy Amedee is with us. She's a writer, social critic, social activist. She is a columnist whose column appears in several cities in the country. And now you're going to tell us about intergenerational or cross-generational activism.
A couple of years ago, people who were noticing that we were having an increasingly older or aging population began saying, you know, we can't afford to support our senior citizens. All that money that it takes to keep them in nursing homes and hospitals and everything is money that we are robbing from our children. We can't afford both. And in fact, there's even an organization that calls itself Americans for Generational Equity that makes those arguments a little less flippantly than I just did. And they call themselves AGE. Well, on the face of it, there's a kernel there that sounds reasonable. We do indeed have an aging population, and we certainly do have somewhat limited resources, right? So we're always...
That's what we're told. We have limited resources.
Right. Okay. Along come some people who I think have saner heads who say, wait a second. We are not a third world country. We may have some limitations, but we are not a poor country. We can certainly afford to have two generations or three generations alive at the same time. And just because we make sure we help older people meet their health care needs, it doesn't mean we have to be robbing our children. We could be making different choices. We could be arranging our budget so that that's not a problem. And it is not necessarily the case that having an older population is going to leave us without enough young workers to support older and younger alike. Just not true. So they have been forming something called Generations United. It's the Child Welfare League of America, the Children's Defense Fund, the Children's Advocates, together with the AARP, American Association of Retired Persons, the National Council of Senior Citizens, National Council on Aging. So across generations now, they are working together to say, wait a minute, among the things that have been established just within the last couple of years is that it is possible to look at what is known as the dependency ratio, the number of working people or economically active people to, say, retirees, and to have it come out in a good light. There is a way of looking at this which says, don't just take the number of Americans over 65 and make a ratio with the number of Americans between the ages of 20 and 64 and say that that tells you whether or not you're going to have a good or a bad dependency ratio, because that's not the whole story. What you have to do instead is look at who is economically active and who's economically dependent across the generations. And so what you do instead is you look at how many people are in the workforce, over 65 as well as under 65 of any age, and you look at the differences from the past and on up to the present of who is in the workforce in that 20 to 64 block, and you'll find there are a lot more women in the workforce, for example, than there were 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. And then you also have to look at the number of young dependents. And what you'll find is that there are fewer young dependents than there were 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. In fact, if you look back to when Social Security started paying out benefits back around 1940, and you use this new ratio of how many economically dependent people are there on every economically active person in the workforce, you'll find that the dependency ratio is the best it's been since Social Security began to be paid out back around 1940. And given what we know about the changes in our population in the near future, it's going to continue to look very good.
Well, also, it wasn't
so long ago that people were forced to retire at an early age.
Absolutely.
So these people were put in a dependency status, but now they can work longer.
That's right.
So that should help out also.
That's right. And for those who have good health, there's frequently an added reason to continue to work and be active, and they continue to be economically active.
But there's a twist to this also. As we know, those of us who were adults during the 50s or even growing up during that time, 40s, 50s, and 60s, we know that the family could be supported very well by a single income,
mm-hmm.
generally the father.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's not the case. To have any kind of a standard of living, the wife has to work.
Mm-hmm.
It also, during the late 60s and early to mid-70s, a single-parent woman. It was tough, but she could make it. Now it's almost impossible for a single-parent woman to take care of her family.
That's right.
And so, although this looks good for the dependency statistics, it, on the other hand, it indicates that the economic system just is closing in on people and is not delivering the goods as it was few decades ago.
I'm going to agree with you, but then I'm also going to give you another couple of reasons not to feel quite so gloomy about it. It is certainly true that the minimum wage has not kept pace as it ought to, and we've got to do something about wages or about making sure that people on low wages are able to meet the basics, a roof over their head, a way to pay the doctor, food on the table. Right now, people can be working full-time all year and still be poor and not able to meet the basics, and that you're absolutely correct about that. At the same time, however, there's another little piece of good news in the way the dependency ratio has been changing, because we also have to take into account what Social Security has done. 40 years ago, those older people were economically dependent, not just because they were older and because they were forced out of the workforce, but because they had no other source of income once they stopped working. Now, at least, Social Security has provided a bit of a cushion underneath everyone and has provided a margin of economic security for everybody that they didn't have 40 years ago. So that changes the picture as well. And as more and more women are in the workforce, more and more older women are going to be able to draw on Social Security as they reach retirement. That is a real difference from 30 years ago, when older parents had to turn to their still working age sons and daughters for most of their support. Now that's just not the case anymore, because at least there's $400 or $500 or $600 or $700 from Social Security, and it does make a big difference. Thank goodness.
We've read about the terrible effects which the Reaganomics has had on the poor and the elderly and all. Is this as bad as it was forecast and as people as anticipated?
Oh, sure. I don't mean to sound flip about it, but there's no question that when you're talking about an issue like poverty and people say, well, what's the solution? We actually know what the solution is. If poverty is a lack of income, then money is the solution, right? How you get it is a bit of a question, but there's no question about what the solution is. People without a source of income, when given a source of income, become less poor.
Hey, I can understand that.
You can get that. All right. That's why Social Security works, right?
Yeah.
People who in the past would have had no source of income when they retired or when they became disabled, you give them a source of income, they become less poor. And that's why poverty among senior citizens has been cut by about two-thirds in just the last quarter of a century. That's a dynamite success story, and we ought to be able to do even better before long. Well, Reaganomics came along and affected virtually anybody whose income was not already very, very high. And in some ways, I object to talking about what Reaganomics did to poor people, because I don't think it was just poor people who were affected. A lot of middle-class people, a lot of working people
were affected. Done away with the middle class to a great degree.
Well, certainly the middle class has been shrinking, as in part because of the economic policies, the tax policies, the wage policies, and the Reaganomics policies of the last couple of years. And as that shrinks, we find more and more people who are maybe just one man or one paycheck away from welfare.
Plus, the fact is, to stay middle class, they have to have that extra paycheck. Both parents or both people have to work.
That's right. So Reaganomics, I think, has had an impact on more than just poor people, but on everybody who isn't the very rich people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a handful of people who did very well, but it's particularly affected anybody who has a family member who has any kind of problem at all, even if it's a temporary problem, even if you're just going through a spell of bad health, even if you're if you've got somebody who's temporarily disabled or somebody who's going through an emotional problem, or if you, if a parent dies and for a time the other parent and the children's lives are in a little bit of chaos. In the past, there were services you could turn to, there were people you could turn to, there were agencies you could turn to. All of them have been to some degree affected by Reaganomics. And I think everybody's life has been made a little less good. Certainly people who have to take public transportation to get to work have been affected by Reaganomics. Anybody who wants to send their child to college has been affected by Reaganomics. Anybody who hopes that they are going to be able to pay their doctor bills when they get sick has been affected by Reaganomics. Many, many people have been affected by it. Had a lot of optimistic things to say. I'm now going to say something that's going to sound a little bit contradictory, because in the midst of all the good things that are going on and all the efforts that people are making to make their corner of the world a little nicer, it is unavoidably true that we do have a growing problem of poverty in this country, and that our poverty population is changing. If we had to describe now who's poor in America, you could do it in three phrases. Poor people are very young, they are poorer, and they are more likely to be employed. The first one is easy. 40% of our poor people are kids. They're not people old enough to be in the working force or be drawing Social Security. They're little kids. 40%.
Oh, you mean the teenagers and below?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, who are in poor families.
That's right.
Okay.
We are the only industrialized nation in the world for whom the largest group in poverty is kids. That is not something to be proud of. Poorer. The poverty line for a family of three is about $8,600. But before you get excited about whether or not you could support two teenagers on $8,500 a year...
They can eat that much in food.
They eat that much, right? But 4 out of 10... in our poor families have half the poverty line or less. Now think about how you'd manage with two teenagers on $4,300 a year. That's what we're talking about for a lot of people. Remember, the poverty line is just the top line, and anybody who's in the poverty count has income below that. Well, a lot of poor people have very little income at all, and that amount has been going down. So our poor are getting poorer, and they're also... Our poor, between the poor and the rich, there is a growing gap. They're getting poorer in that sense as well. But the third and I think most sobering thing is something you touched on in an earlier conversation. And that is that increasingly now you can be working and still poor. More of our poor are likely to be living in the household of working people. Out of 33 million people officially counted as poor, 9 million are working people. And then, of course, there are the retirees and there are the kids who are in the families of those working people. So that takes up a lot of the poor people. Excuse me. The largest single cause of poverty in our country today is not people who are unwilling to work, but people who do work and just don't earn enough.
And people who can't find work, too. I mean, the unemployment is much worse.
Very
than
serious.
What the...
And underemployment. Mm-hmm. People who can't find enough work.
And also there's another aspect, too. I've read a lot of stories about the feminization of poverty, that mm-hmm. most of these kids you're talking about are in single-parent families.
Not most.
No.
But a lot. True. Because for a woman heading a family alone, a job alone is not enough.
As a percentage, the single-parent family is poorer than the...
Two-parent family. Oh,
right?
Absolutely. No question about it. Sure. Well, again, it's pretty basic. If you've got a chance for two incomes... Or if you've got a chance for one person to be out earning while another one is home looking after the children and you don't have to pay for child care, your income situation is likely to be better. If you have only a chance for one income and that one income also has to go to pay a child care provider, then you've got a much bigger problem on your hands. Just think, if you were making the minimum wage right now, and a lot of women do, that's $3.35 an hour times 40 hours a week times 52 weeks a year. That's $6,968 a year. By the way, I worked it out earlier. I didn't do the math in my head right now. Anyway, if for less than $7,000 in income, you have to set aside $2,500 a year for child care, And that's not fancy child care. That's maybe 50, 60, 70 cents an hour, maybe 90 cents an hour, depending on whether or not you live close to the babysitter. $2,500 out of your $7,000 means that you've got $4,500 a year on which to support yourself and your children. You just can't do it on that kind of money, and that's for fully employed people.
How do these figures compare with other Western capitalist countries?
Well, we are not doing as well as other countries because our social insurance system is not as fleshed out, and we are one of the few industrialized nations of the world that does not have a children's allowance. 62 nations of the world make sure that every child in their country gets a benefit every month without fail, a taxable benefit, so that wealthier people pay it back to the treasury in taxes, but people who are not wealthy keep it, and it helps them not be poor if they've got children in their family. It's very important. We don't do that. We're not so good with our kids. As a matter of fact, you know, for a smart country, we do a lot of dumb things. We don't make sure that our people can eat. We don't make sure that they're going to have health care when they need it. We don't even make sure that they can get immunizations to ward off the threat of communicable diseases. We do a lot of funny things for a lot of smart people. You know, the thing that amazes me the most, though, is that we could wipe out poverty. 25 years ago, Michael Harrington wrote his book, The Other America. In that 25 years, we have learned an enormous amount about poverty in our country. At that time, we didn't have basic statistics, we didn't have information, we didn't have studies all across the country, we didn't have poverty institutes, we didn't have research institutes devoted to this stuff. Boy, we didn't know much of anything about poverty in America when the war on poverty was launched. Well, we learned a lot through that war on poverty, and we learned a lot from all the things that have been put in place since. And we now know a lot about reducing poverty. And in fact, the issue now is not information or technical or any of those things. It's strictly political. We could make this nation of ours a poverty-free zone by the year 2000. That's what we ought to set about doing.
Let's return now to our interview with our two Gray Panthers. Francis Humphreys, who's the director of the Gray Panthers National Office in Washington, D.C., and Irv Riskin, who's on the Membership and Organizing Committee for the Panthers.
Irv, you were a labor leader and labor organizer back in the 30s, and those were rough times. I mean, people were getting killed and getting their heads bashed in, but now you're organizing for the Gray Panthers. Which is easiest?
Well, I would say organizing for the seniors, and through the Gray Panthers, organizing older people, and a lot of people have bought into the myths that have been generated about aging. You know, all our lives, since we were young, through the media, all kinds of the media, through the magazines, through radio and television, we have learned that when we get old, we're going to be sick, that we're going to be useless, no longer a part of society. Unfortunately, many people have bought into these stereotypes, and as a result, we find that many people, older people particularly, have withdrawn from the mainstream of life. One of our major concerns is to deal with these stereotypes, to convince people that age is not a criterion for their ability to hold a job down, to perform any kind of a function, and that there is no magic about being 65 one day when just the day before you were 64 and 360 days. And this is the major concept that we have to deal with, that older people, many of my generation, have bought into these concepts, and many young people today. We spend billions of dollars in this country to try and hide our age. You know, we dye our hair, you know, we get our faces lifted, our nose jobs, wrinkles removed, and we're proud of the fact that we are old, as Maggie Coon calls us, the wrinkled radicals. And we feel that we have a contribution because everybody's going to be old someday.
Or gray is beautiful.
That's right. So. And I think this conception of gray as we use it, I think we ought to explain it. Gray is mm-hmm. not the color. We don't use gray as a color of our hair.
Okay.
We use gray as the blend and the mixture of all the colors. black, white, all of the people working together. And it's the blending of all of these colors that we refer to as gray. And that's what the Gray Panthers say. Well, we're working with all the people, whatever their age.
You know, I was reading, maybe you saw this, I guess it was about, gosh, must have been about 15 years or so ago. I saw an article in National Geographic in which they tried to find the oldest people in the world, and they did, as well as they could. There were groups of them living in the Soviet Union, in Central Asia, around Tashkent, and others who were living up in the Andes.
The Hunzas.
They were all people over 100 years old. And they found they had several things in common. They were still working. They were considered equal and valued members of the community. They had domestic, family, active sex lives. They had a lot of good exercise. They worked, had a job, and they also lived up high in high altitudes where the weather was good. It was so interesting that they talked to one fellow. The oldest one they could find was 125, and they said, would you like to be young again? And he said, no, but I'd like to be 100. But it's very different in these societies where ageism, age prejudice, does not exist.
Would you like to describe ageism? In fact, probably many people have heard the word sexism and racism. What is ageism?
Ageism is any time that you assume that a person will behave in a certain way because of their age. Irv said it a minute ago, age is just not the criteria. Last summer, when we were working on the mandatory retirement, the ending of the mandatory retirement at age 70, one of the things that they said was, do you want a policeman to, or would you expect a policeman to be able to perform his job if he or she is, say, 70 years old? We said some people can't perform that job at age 30. That's just not the criteria. So any time that you'd make an assumption based on age that a person will be a certain way, that's ageism.
Well, this
a presumption.
It's tremendously stacked all throughout our culture, our society. Doug, you analyze films and all the images of older people in films is just wretched.
And it's a youth culture, advertising, television, film, the models of beauty, of power, of success are always youth.
Yes, and it's the idea that when you make this assumption mm-hmm. that a person will behave in a certain way, you're making the assumption that it will be a negative behavior.
Right.
That's the thing, too, to stress. You're saying that they won't be able to do something, or they aren't qualified to do something, or it's strictly based on their age.
One positive thing which is being done in Dallas, Texas, is a public access TV program, a series which is made by and for the senior citizens. It's organized by the American Association of Retired People. Carol Lewis, formerly with the Texas Department on Aging, made this mini documentary showing how it's done.
Ready on the set. Then we have our program, it's called Top of the Line. And it's presented by AARP and all kinds of the people that produce the show, who run the cameras and the switchers and everything, are people your age. It's all done. All the production is done by people your age, by senior citizens.
Oh,
every stinking bit of it. I mean, ask her. She saw them all this morning. Isn't that wonderful?
I know.
And none of them have ever had any video experience. They've never been in a television studio. And they're in front of the camera. They're doing, we're going to get you to come out and play your banjo. I just, wait till I tell them I found a banjo player.
Okay.
different sorts of services to senior citizens. It's convenient for those agencies, and it's convenient for the elderly to participate in the program.
It really is. They can call just that one number. What's the number again?
638-0316.
That's right. And you can just find out just about everything from there. You're just good people. Are there health clinics and dental care available in all these places?
There are indeed. We do work with the City of Dallas, Dallas County Health Departments.
How did it ever get started?
An advertisement in the newspaper, and it was also announced in the AARP chapters that there would be a special orientation course for AARP members at the Lover's Lane Methodist Church. And we met over there on the first day of May when there was a tornado alert out for 50 counties in North Texas that day, and they told us what it was about and encouraged us to take the course. So we took the course, and then we went on from there. We did two shows a month, one at Richland Studio and one at Wynwood Studio.
The city and the county is represented by state representatives who go towards making legislation happen on the state level. And then on the city level, we do have some activity in our county government and our city government. You take, for instance, just recently, the city received a grant of $16 million from the federal government.
They had tried to get me into Warner Amex TV quite a few years back, but at the time I wasn't available. But I met Barbara Dixon down there one day, and she talked about starting this group and told me where they were going to meet. And at that time I wasn't a member of AARP at all, and hadn't really heard much about it. So that's how I heard about it. And I've been with them right from the very beginning. I don't think I worked on just about every show but one in some capacity. I thought it was just one of the most interesting and challenging things that I've done in a long, long time. It's been just really great for me.
I heard that I could go out here to the Dallas School Board.
D-I-S-D.
D-I-S-D.
Dallas Independent.
And they were going to talk about getting a bunch of senior citizens. That's me, if not have you recognize it. They're going to take us senior citizens out there and show us how to run that camera and do all the other little goodies. So I went out there on the first go around, and I sat there and heard them tell about it. It looked fairly easy to me. I think, well, I believe I'll go try it. So I joined up with the ARC. I wasn't even a ARC member at that time.
No, I wasn't
either. I thought I was too young, you know.
I retired.
I thought that was very old.
Did it turn out to be as easy as you thought it was going to be?
No, it's something that I have to do two or three times to learn.
No, it's not all that easy. A lot of technical.
I found out, though, that any of it, if you do it 1,000 times, it gets easy.
But it's not that easy, is it?
Mostly
you know.
I practice my mistakes.
Yeah, you got to practice.
This involves a large amount of money. But does the government provide all this?
The federal government provides the lion's share of
the
program. Is about a $1.7 million program.
Just
money comes from the Texas Department of Aging, through the Community Council of Greater Dallas, the County Commissioner's Court also contributes a large amount of money, and the 33 co-sponsoring agencies that help with the facilities, utilities, vehicles, and in some instances with staff for those centers to make a big contribution. We also look to our participants and volunteers.
We usually tape on the third Wednesday morning, and we have a host, generally, and different guests. We do different types of shows, but generally it's an interview format, and we have a host and different guests, and they talk about different subjects. We've done things like, we did a great one on marriage after 60, with a marriage counselor there, and with a couple of our people who are all hams, acting out a marital dispute.
I do have to say, speaking of camera, how it has totally changed my outlook, though. I watched the Taylor dancers the other night. They were simply fabulous, but had they been terrible, the camera work was such that I would have been so fascinated with the camera work that I wouldn't have cared.
They were terrible.
It was marvelous. There was never too much or too little headroom. They always had the leaping dancer coming in precisely correctly. Either the director of the ballet himself checked that camera and did that camera, or they had practiced for a month in advance. It was not anything easy. As you know and I know.
I am interested in aging issues, you know, because that's the department I work for. But if an older person is on the air doing something, you know, then probably the audience, you know, some people are going to watch him who wouldn't watch him if otherwise.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, all avenues are good avenues to get into, especially with this cable TV, since, you know, it opens things up for people who couldn't otherwise afford to get on the networks. And that one thing is disseminating information or creating a positive image of aging. And the other is just neat ways of intergenerational type activities, you know, that can take place. But people need to be informed of, you know, that this is out there and that they can do it.
We ask our two Gray Panther guests, Irv Riskin and Francis Humphreys, what they do on a personal basis to resist the stereotyping and age prejudice against older people.
One way is by example. We just simply show that when we're, whatever age we are, we're out there doing the job that we do best. And if we're just saying that when you're 65, that doesn't mean that you won't do whatever you've been doing all of your life. One of the things that struck me about Maggie Coon was that here was a woman at age 65 who had been an activist. She had been developing educational materials. She had been speaking. She had been organizing. She had been working for large organizations, and one day she was this active, valued person. The very next day, at age 65, on her birthday, she had to be retired from her job because we had mandatory retirement. So what did they give her for her retirement? Did they give her something appropriate to what her life had been? No, they gave her a sewing machine. And here's a woman who had never really had any interest in sewing, but she was more or less, not more or less, she was just told by society that now it's time for you to go home. And
So that wasn't just ageism. We think that was sexism, too.
Okay, yes,
a combination
right.
of
yes.
both, that a woman's really. Place is mm-hmm. in the home. Mm-hmm. And this is part of what we've been dealing with.
So to counter that, what did Maggie do? Maggie went right on doing what she did best, organizing, developing, making speeches, just doing the things that she'd been doing all along. And she's still doing it now at age 82.
Let's meet this remarkable woman, Maggie Coon. Here is an excerpt from a previous program in which we showed a portion of Maggie's remarks at a symposium at the University of Texas in early 1981.
Age today constitutes an enormous challenge to the whole society. And how a society deals with age and the issues of age puts the whole society to the test, and is a measure of its decline and its decadence, or its health and vitality and its own humanity. We believe that the elders of a society are mandated by virtue of their eldership to be the conservators, the preservers of society, mm-hmm. and to use their freedom and their experience in order that the survival of the society can be guaranteed. Now, if you're just out for me, and there are many, many old people who take that very selfish, self-serving view. Granted, their needs are great, but to be only concerned about oneself and that one's grandchildren or the kids on the block is, from my point of view, a rejection of the role of the elder. And I would look to Mr. Reagan, the oldest president in our present history, to be the responsible elder of America. The children who are deprived under the cutbacks of school lunches, the young people who may not be able to go to college because there are cutbacks in student loan funds. I would expect that old people who would be also involved in the debate to make Social Security viable and more just, particularly for older women, that there would be a continuing discussion about how the future can be guaranteed, how the environment can be safe and viable. Gray Panthers have two specific plans in mind, decentralized approaches to housing. We have devised, and others are helping with, a shared housing plan that would enable old and young people to share their space, to use existing housing stock, which would keep neighborhoods viable, help to revitalize old neighborhoods that are facing decline and decay. It would provide shelter for young people, particularly students and young marrieds and single parent families, which have tremendous hardship in the present housing market. And it would enable hundreds of thousands of old people who have big old houses, which they own and which they find it very difficult to maintain and pay taxes on and heat. Those houses could be shared. That space could be intergenerationally developed in every community across the country. We're looking for new legislation that would make this legal, that would enable housing and zoning codes that prevent this use of housing space. And we hope that the world, particularly the Western world, might like to look at what the Gray Panthers define as a family. Mm-hmm. We think of the family as a group of persons, two or more, who share goals, resources, lifestyles, and values over time. A network of people bound together in mutual responsibility and decision-making that transcends blood, legal ties, adoption, and marriage. That kind of a family is the family of the future.
Maggie, what's your perspective?
I think it's part of the social pathology of our time. It goes back to the separation of the old from the young, of some of the ways in which we have set up our housing policies, for example, that isolate old people in senior high-rises, and the Sun Cities and Leisure Worlds that affluent old people assign themselves to live in, away from children and young people. I think that's ultimately feeding the fire of ageism. It's giving us a galloping epidemic of gerontophobia. Mm-hmm. And I see no way of dealing with crime in the ultimate sense until the people get to know each other. We're concerned about the breakdown of neighborhoods. If neighbors look after each other, there can be some improvement. I've been concerned about the joblessness of minority and other young people. When millions of young people have no hope of a decent job ever, and when we in an affluent society, the media tempt people with all kinds of enticements to buy things that they can't afford, and that they never can and earn the money to afford, crime is inevitable. It's a dreadful thing. I love to think that we could return to a neighborhood setting where you didn't have to put three locks on your doors. And there are millions of my peers across the country who would literally live in self-imposed house arrest.
Mm-hmm.
They never go out. The jails are full of kids. There are many, many things that we've got to do in this troubled, tumultuous age. And I like to think that we can, in this particular period, look forward. I think I'm very distressed about the gloom and the despair and the hopelessness that many people feel today. And I think that we need to generate some new energy that provides hope. And I like to think that young people and old people together can provide that energy, and that in small groups, in neighborhoods, in places where we come together to learn, in the lifetime learning centers that Marion referred to, in churches and synagogues, on great campuses like this, there can be coming together of people in small groups to do something different.
Now let's return to September of 1987 and our two Gray Panthers.
There's a very interesting story about relating to this. I don't know if you're aware of Satchel Paige.
Oh, yeah.
The baseball
Satchel
player. Paige, the baseball
yeah.
player, was black, and so for many years, because of the discrimination in baseball, he could not play ball.
Right. Even though he was probably the greatest
pitcher.
He
was one of the greatest pitchers of all time. And I lived in New York and would see him in what they called the black leagues, like playing with different groups. So I was fortunate to see one of the greatest pitchers of all times that most Americans couldn't see.
Yeah. Most of us only got to see him when he was older,
right.
in his 50s.
Now, he was in Cleveland, pitching in Cleveland one day, and he was, I guess, close to 60 at that time, when 55, and one of the newspaper reporters came over and says, "Satchel, how do you feel pitching? You're so old." And Satchel turned around to him and said, "Tell me something. How old would you be if you didn't know how old you were?" And he was making a very important point.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how old you are. He still, at that time, for a couple of years, was a great pitcher. And age had nothing to do with it. And I think that really explains in a lot of way what our concept mm-hmm. is. Every age is a good age. We can make a contribution to society at every age. And that is what the Great Panthers really are saying. We can live with dignity at every age, part of the mainstream, not sitting on rockers waiting for our maker, but participating in the life of our nation. And we have a lot to contribute.
In fact, over the last couple of decades, you've been very active in the peace movement. What are some of the current peace issues that the Gray Panthers have been working on?
Well, of course, just a few weeks ago, we participated in the peace march in Washington.
Right.
In the Washington office, we have just been telling Congress how we felt about the SALT II treaty, how we adherence to the SALT II treaty, the nuclear testing. Irv, you wanted
Star Wars.
Star Wars is
Star Wars. Well, we just one of the major activities that we are doing at this period of time is we're circulating a peace appeal, which originated with the United Nations. It's a petition that's being circulated that at the same time is being circulated in the Soviet Union. And it's appeal to the people of both countries to end the nuclear arms race and all of this war and Cold War that exists. We have a goal of 1 million signatures, which we intend to present to a city in the Soviet Union that had been in sort of a challenge with us, who can secure the most signatures. And I don't know if we've achieved a million signatures. It was a pretty good goal, but we have thousands and thousands of signatures from people all over, and there's going to be a presentation taking place very shortly where the names of the Americans who signed this petition will be presented to
the people in the Soviet Union, they in turn will set it to us.
Well, the Grey Panther sounds like a great organization. How can people, if they're interested, join it? Do you have a phone number and a national address that it can be given?
We have a phone number, but I think we'd like to call attention to one of our most active networks, and one that we're very proud of right here in the city of Austin, which has is sponsoring this conference that we're in. And I think it would be very good if, as a result of this, all of our inquiries would be referred to our Austin people, who they in turn will see that it reaches the people throughout the country.
Well, we really appreciate you coming in and telling us about the Grey Panthers. And
thank you very much.
Keep up the good work.
Youth and age in action. And that's what we believe is important. Young and old working together, and the people in between.
And that brings us to the end of another Alternative Views. Glad you could join us. You might be interested that the Grey Panthers in Austin have worked in coalition with the following groups on specific issues: the Texas Alliance for Human Needs, Public Citizen, League of Women Voters, Texas Council on Family Violence, Human Serve, Austin YMCA, Black Citizens Task Force, Advocacy Incorporated, Coalition of Texans with Disabilities, People First, Metro Ministries, American Civil Liberties Union, Austin Peace and Justice Coalition, CARE Coalition, Austin Women's Center. Also, the Consumers Association, Coalition of Elders, Consumers Union, Junior League, and Common Cause. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'd like to thank our camera and audio man, Kevin West, for doing a super job today, and Austin Community Television, ACTV. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. If you have any inquiries about the program or any comments, please write to us at that address. We'd enjoy hearing from you. Goodbye. Million viewers, and we raise a grand total, if we're lucky, of about $6,000 a year, which is about as much as Jimmy Swaggart raises in 20 minutes. Well, thank you for watching Alternative Views, and we'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.